intelligence emerges from the world. It's not something that just exists within our own heads. And so you have this quite odd situation where we keep talking about this thing called artificial intelligence, as though it were possible for intelligence to be artificial or unnatural, rather than being something that emerges from the world. And that's why I say that AI is just, you know, a small part of everything else, because everything is just a small part of everything else.
Hello and welcome to the Culture and Technology Podcast, a series of conversations where we explore emerging technologies and their impact on culture, brought to you by the Vienna Business Agency. This is the first episode of Season 4, and my name is Severin Matusek. I'm a writer and researcher based in Berlin, and today's guest is James Bridle, an artist and author of two of my favorite books on technology, New Dark Age and Ways of Being. Their latest book, Ways of Being, couldn't have come out at a better time. In spring 2023, when we talked, AI applications such as ChatGPT-3 and Midjourney took over the world by storm. They not only opened up unprecedented possibilities, but also made us rethink some of the questions that define who we are as a species. What is intelligence? What makes it artificial? And how is our understanding of intelligence connected to the way we relate to our environment? I believe that AI makes us reconsider who we are and how we relate to this world. But what does that mean for each of us individually and how we use these technologies? That's precisely what I wanted to find out from James.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely, as you say, increased interest in sort of questions around AI, what it is and what it means. But I think there's also a kind of bigger questions around ecology that I think as a society, even as a civilization, we're kind of coming towards. And really, you know, I think AI sucks up a lot of attention in the short term. But, you know, really my feelings about it, my understanding of it is it's AI is really part of something much, much bigger that's slowly coming into view. And if this is part of that coming into view, then great.
How would you explain that connection between what we call artificial intelligence and ecology, and how both of them are connected or shape our relationship to the world?
Well, so, I mean, I've been thinking about AI and related technologies for quite a long time. And the thing that's sort of become apparent, this doesn't require particularly thinking about artificial intelligence or any of those big kind of complex philosophical ideas around technology. It's just really important to understand that technology, like everything else, is inseparable from the world around us. For a long time, my work has been about the effect of technology on culture, on society, on our daily lives. Some of that work, for example, was like looking at the carbon emissions of data centers, talking about the fact that when you process large amounts of information, when you use social media or anything else, you know, you're making computers do work, and those computers produce heat and carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases and so on and so forth. And of course, computers are made out of the earth. They're made out of rocks and sand and stones and the bodies of sea creatures that died billions of years ago. And so everything's connected to the earth. Everything is connected. There's really no such thing as nature or the environment as something separate from us that we can kind of stand beside or outside and look at. We're all utterly kind of enmeshed and entangled with it. That's the understanding, the realization of ecology. It says that everything is connected. And this is true of qualities like intelligence as well. Intelligence emerges from the world. It's not something that just exists within our own heads. And so you have this quite odd situation where we keep talking about this thing called artificial intelligence, as though it were possible for intelligence to be artificial or unnatural, rather than being something that emerges from the world. And that's why I say that AI is just, you know, a small part of everything else, because everything is just a small part of everything else. Everything is connected in these really important ways that matter and produce the world. And I'm interested in finding those connections and seeing what we can learn from different pieces, kind of putting them together, but always with this emphasis that there's no separation, there's no distance between us and the world. Everything is totally entangled, us, non-human animals, plants, ecosystems, and even machines.
Yeah, you just mentioned the connection between artificial intelligence and ecology and how it's all connected. And my question on responding to that was, where does this notion come from that technology is separate from us? And where does the notion come from that artificial intelligence is this omnipowerous thing that we don't really understand, which I think is something you try to dismantle in your writing.
I think there's a couple of things going on. The first of which, you know, contemporary technology is often kind of mystified. It's given this kind of sheen of something that's so strange and complex that it can't really be understood. I mean, that's in part because it is quite complex. Let's not pretend it's not, in that, you know, you need some kind of specialized knowledge and so on and so forth to unpick it. It's often surrounded by quite complex mathematics and so on and so forth. But that's not to say it can't be understood. In fact, really, I always absolutely insist that really anyone can understand what's going on. And so beyond that, what you have is a deliberate obfuscation. And that obfuscation happens, you know, for reasons of kind of political power and technological efficiency, not entirely consciously, but with very bad ends. And what I mean by that is that there's a drive within the creation of technology to make things more simple. That's a kind of marketing drive, kind of selling point that, oh, you know, you don't need to understand this because it will just work and it will just do the things you need it to do. And we'll tell you what those things that you need are, and then we will fulfill those needs for profit. That's the kind of standard sales pitch of capitalism. But when it gets applied to technology, something really terrible happens, which is that almost everyone, apart from the people who make the technology and make the money, lose all their agency. Because once you don't know how the system you're using is working, you don't see what it's doing and you can't learn from it. Take the example of like one of those delivery food apps. The promise of that app is that it makes it all simple, right? You just select from a menu, you hit a button, the food turns up on your doorstep. You don't need to do or think anything else. But what's actually happening is that people are being put into motion. Cooks are working in kitchens, delivery drivers are out in the rain, and that system is also actively oppressing those people, right? Because it's driving down their wages and it's disaggregating their labor relationships, making it harder for them to like do collective action to improve their labor conditions. It's doing a whole bunch of stuff within the labor system that is completely invisible to you using the app. So every time something is made easy in that way, a bunch of stuff is hidden away. And usually that allows for like bad things to happen. The second thing that's happening within there is that you're losing out. By not understanding the systems that you're using all the time, we are losing the opportunity to learn about them. We could be more powerful because computers, technology, these tools, they actually do allow us to do more powerful things. And we're kind of giving up that power by allowing ourselves to be told that this is too complex, that we should just have it easy, and that we shouldn't try and understand what's going on. Because if you do understand, if you do that little bit of work, you will become empowered. You will be capable of acting more in different ways. And you'll be capable of defining and fulfilling your own needs and desires, rather than having them defined by a technology that's in turn defined by a corporation with its own kind of profit desires. And so that's what's happening at the level of the kind of immediate technology, when we say about what we don't understand about AI. But you can push it back a lot further than that, which is into this kind of separation between the sort of technology and the world, ultimately the separation between us and the world, which goes back a lot further, which hundreds of years, possibly even thousands of years, in specifically like Western European culture. You can take it back to the Enlightenment and look at the development of a natural science that saw the world as something separate from humans that could be empirically known as a subject of human inquiry rather than something that we're entangled with. The symptoms of that are things like treating other organisms as mechanisms. The Descartesian idea that the animals and plants are just machines that we can take apart and examine to see how they work like a clockwork mechanism, irregardless of their own pain or individuality or their own experience. And you can go all the way back to the beginning of agriculture and the harnessing and domestication of animals and the belief that humans have dominion over the earth in a kind of religious way, and therefore that everything else on this planet is for our own use. All of these are stages of kind of alienation and estrangement from the world around us, of which the kind of worship of AI as some kind of super intelligent extraterrestrial being is just the latest type kind.
Responding to your answer on agency and control, this makes a lot of sense to me to build up agency and capacity instead of, you know, being so reliant on technology. But the development we see over the last decades is definitely that technology makes things more and more convenient and builds less capacity in us. So for each individual, do you think it has to be a conscious individual choice to resist these convenient food delivery, everything else, apps and technologies? Or can there be some broader systemic change in the way we use technology?
I think, as always, the answer is both. It does require a certain kind of individual consciousness. Like you have to want to do it. And that requires sort of being aware of it and thinking about it. But also it's not something that's very easy to do completely alone. These things are better done collectively. Of course, the best possible answer would be societal level change, in which we completely reformed our education systems and our both childhood education and higher education, in which, various different things were valued in various ways, that critical thinking was central to our kind of education practices. And that's like big, broad education policy stuff. We have been utterly failed by our education systems for quite some time. So, of course, in the longest term, at the biggest scale, that's necessary. I think there's other things to do at the kind of, collective level between groups of people. And there's, powerful movements within that, I think, that address things. I think of things like the open source movement, and I think of kind of various forms of kind of digital and knowledge activism that do work to empower people. Again, they rely on people being willing to engage with those things. And then, of course, there's, self-education. It's like, how much do you want to think about and understand the tools you use every day? And where do you, where will you find benefits from? On that level, I can mostly only speak to my own experience. And I use lots of these apps that I critique and whatever as well. But I also do other things to try and both, retain an awareness of how those things function and also to learn as much as possible about them. For many years, I've run workshops and done various things where you teach people little bits of code, or you show them certain things about how they can make the internet work differently, or whatever it is. These quite simple things that are not necessarily about turning everyone into some kind of super user who totally transforms their life in particular ways. But it's about giving people just enough agency that they can take charge of the situation when they need to and when they want to, when they know that they can do that, when they have the confidence to do it. Because agency is in large part a kind of psychological position where you need to know that you can intervene, that your decisions matter. That you can control your own kind of experiences and state and fulfill your own desires. Only individuals really know what they need in that situation. So it's not really about teaching one specific skill. It's about teaching this kind of ability to critically inquire, and critically the ability to learn, to once you have identified what it is that you need to do, to be able to learn how to do it. And it's that ability to learn that actually is the real kind of habit that needs cultivating. And it's paradoxically the habit that is absolutely driven out of us by most education and by most of our experiences in daily life. Because in education, we're told what we should know. We're not encouraged to find out or to explore for ourselves. And in daily life, we're constantly told, like, you don't need to know this. This isn't your business. This isn't part of your job. This isn't whatever it is. And so there's all these kind of strictures put on what it is that we should like to know, which is the opposite of being like a concerned, inquiring citizen, in which one has some kind of say and agency and ability to shape one's own life.
So you mentioned that basically, like, it's a psychological mindset that we can all apply in one way or another to our lives. I'm particularly interested and also inspired by the way it seems you apply a lot of your thinking to your own life. I know that you've moved to a Greek island a few years ago. You are involved in a lot of local community work. You do a lot of artistic and practical work, thinking about and acting with technology. Can you tell us a little bit about the evolution of your own practice in that way? Like, when did it start that your thinking on technology also was put into practice in the way you live with technology? Was this early on, or did you only later in life come to the point that you want to experiment with that also in a more practical way?
When I first started using computers, they were just these little boxes that you had to write code for in order for them to do anything. This is getting into some serious sort of graybeard when I was young stuff, but like the first computers that I used were the famous in the UK computers called the BBC Micro. And what was amazing about the BBC Micro was when you turned it on, you were just given a command line. There was just a blinking cursor there. And in order for you to get it to do anything, you had to write the code to tell it what to do. It's an amazing kind of learning machine. And when, you know, you hear today that computers are too complicated to use, like I, you know, immediately remember being in a classroom entirely filled with like 9-year-old children who just code it, right? When given that opportunity, just got on with it and write code. You know, and we used to type whole computer games into these things. And that was a system that was entirely designed around learning and exploration and produced these very different outcomes as a result. Next thing that happened to me is that the computer systems got more refined, more complicated, and also easier in this way that I'm critiquing. So you got visual operating systems and so on and so forth. And using a desktop computer a few years later, had kind of full operating system that made it kind of harder to code, harder to explore. But then you connected that to the internet. And that was the pre-World Wide Web days, when again, the internet itself was kind of a bit like a command line in that you had to do some pretty complex creative stuff to get it to do anything. And then it did really interesting things and it connected you to all kinds of interesting people and places. So there's a kind of incredible reward for doing that kind of complex creative work. So it drove that kind of exploration and learning. So that's always been a part of like how I've come to use technology. And in my kind of, you know, creative practice for the last decade and a half, I was looking at the ways in which technology kind of impacts everyday life, politics, society, and how shapes our agency and how we can work with that, doing the kind of work that I just mentioned of kind of teaching people simple bits of code or different ways to kind of access or play with systems, essentially in order to transform these kind of little boxes that we carry around with us everywhere that are effectively, you know, barely interactive televisions, unless you learn to code, in which point they magically become the most powerful tools ever gifted to humanity. And that's a really extraordinary transition that doesn't take much to achieve. And so figuring out, you know, how to flip that switch was a big part of my kind of technological work. But in the last few years, I've made this quite conscious effort to reframe my practice a bit more around ecology and the environment. And really that started as a kind of intellectual, social belief that this was important, essentially. Like, we know the way the world is headed. I need to think more and act more ecologically in order to do something about that, or just to even, you know, be present in the world as it actually is today. But I realized that, you know, writing my last book, New Dark Age, which was a kind of critique of a lot of the contemporary technology and the ways we've been talking about, you know, I spent some time in that book writing about the environment, about computers' relationship to the environment, and also broadly just going quite deep into what we understand about climate change and biodiversity loss and so on and so forth in the present moment, and how, like, existentially terrifying that is. And slowly realizing that among many other relations here, one of them is that the position we find ourselves in relationship to the global climate and the global kind of industrial capitalist system at present, which is driving those changes, is very similar to finding ourselves enmeshed in large, you know, complex technological systems that we barely understand and we feel powerless to act within. A few years ago, I found myself, for various reasons, starting to also like work on little regenerative energy tools. I found myself sort of wiring up solar panels to go camping, or building a little kind of solar heater to heat up my cold studio space in the winter without using vast amounts of electricity. And I found that, you know, what I was doing was essentially the same thing as the teaching to code. It was finding things that I could learn that allowed me to kind of stabilize myself within these big, complex, quite frightening systems and give myself some kind of agency, give myself a place to stand within those systems. That then allowed me to think kind of at bigger scale and think more clearly about those systems, which it really wasn't possible unless, as I say, you have this kind of place to stand. And that requires some kind of knowledge or understanding, just a tiny little bit, enough to kind of get aboard. And then you can do all kinds of more interesting things. It doesn't really matter, as I say, whether that little platform is made of like a bit of coding knowledge or it's made of a bit of carpentry knowledge. You know, if you're building these kind of like solar ovens or heaters like I've been building, that's not really what matters. What matters is you feel like you have a place to stand and you have the agency to learn more. So much of my work is about exploring that and trying to encourage it and then seeing what other interesting things we can do with it.
You mentioned this evolution in your approach and thinking from your first book, New Dark Age, to your second book, Ways of Being, which I also observed in a way from an outside perspective, where I'd say New Dark Age, which I think was released in 2018, at that time also really inspired me, because that was kind of like, I thought, the first wave of serious criticism about big tech coming in. You know, 2016, 2017, 2018, Trump election, Brexit, we suddenly as a society understood the broad implications of everyday media and technology we use on society and on the way we live. And I think New Dark Age gave a lot of context to that, but was very critical. I'm not sure if it was pessimistic, but I thought Ways of Being then became this book that was much more optimistic and outlooking, not so much focusing in, zoning in on that technology, but really trying to broaden our perspective and collective imagination of what intelligence is. Would you agree with that? That maybe your perspective changed from like a critique of technology to further ways of just thinking and living with technology in a more optimistic way?
So all of these questions, these words really, optimism and pessimism, and also perspective to some extent, what they do is they create this idea that there is some kind of separation, once again, between a present state and a future possibility, which I try and push back against as much as possible. So New Dark Age was very, very explicitly, and I wrote about this quite a lot in the book, not about predicting the future. And what that meant was that I was really trying very hard just to describe the situation as it actually exists in the present. So I wasn't talking about like weird future uses of technology. I wasn't like saying, wow, you know, if this carries on, this is what will happen. Or like, what happens if like this kind of computer does this weird thing? It's like, this is what's happening right now. Like, this is what's actually happened. I think like we have all become aware of kind of critical technology issues a bit more. But that, I mean, that has a long history. As long as computers have been around, people have been critiquing computers. You know, the moments that you mentioned, I think the Trump election and Brexit, were, you know, are these deeply pivotal moments where we suddenly realized like this thing, this internet we've had, has been around like at scale in public life for 20 years and was supposed to bring all these benefits, and it hasn't. So let's be really super honest about what it's actually doing, how power dynamics are being distributed by this system, and just make a clear state. And, you know, part of that clarity and that refusal of the future as a something which can be separated out from where we are at present was also not to get into kind of solutionizing, trying to come up with like answers, easy or otherwise, to the situation we find ourselves in. Not least because I think that tendency towards solutionizing, which is a terrible word, but it's a very sort of Silicon Valley word, is part of the problem, is the way in which so much like technological discourse operates. It's like, well, you know, this will solve this problem, a problem which often has been created or made up by the technology in the first place, or has been kind of completely misdirected by something else. Like, you know, this will free everyone up to do less work. Well, no, it won't. It just creates more work, etc. You know, that's the way in which that I've tried to position that critique of technology as a critique of what's happening in the present moment. And it's the same with this question of optimism and pessimism relating to the newer work. Yes, Ways of Being very much does come out of me saying like, okay, we've stated the problem, and let's look at like some alternative ways of doing things and of viewing things. But again, I try not to keep it too like future oriented. I want to talk about what actually matters in the present, right? Again, there's no like wild prediction stuff in Ways of Being. It's about the situation as it is now. It's about the understanding that multiple intelligences, non-human agency, the ability to communicate with animals and plants exists right now in the present. And that means we can act right now in the present. I'm a great believer in Aldous Huxley's dictum of means, not ends. What matters is how we act now in the present. That will define the kind of future that we have. And that means that I try to avoid these terms like optimism, pessimism, and I try to concentrate on what actions are possible in the present. Hope is a useful one. Hope is an important one, but hope always needs a place to stand. Like I was talking about with regards to agency, hope is a kind of meaningless emotion if it does not grounded in something that allows you to move towards something else. It has to kind of go somewhere. It needs a place to stand. All of my work is orientated around this like insistence on an honesty about the present, but also an insistence on the possibility of action in the present.
Talking about multiple ways of seeing intelligence, understanding intelligence beyond just human intelligence, there was one thing you mentioned in a recent essay that quite stayed with me, which was where you mentioned we developed these two ways of thinking about the world. Like one is very much based on this rational, binary, almost computational way of understanding the world, which is very much measurable in terms of like digital measures and so on. And then we have the more historic, emotional way of relating to the world. I think you also mentioned it before in the term when you talked about different philosophers separating the human from the world in various ways. And I was kind of thinking about it because I also observed that our thinking has definitely evolved towards a very computational way of seeing the world in numbers, and everything that is basically real has to be measured in some way. And this kind of more emotional or let's say even magical thinking is more and more disappearing. And at the same time, you can see that with climate change, we know the numbers for centuries or years. And it seems like we as humans, though, have to feel it. We have to feel the heat. We have to feel the cold. We have to feel the weird weather. We have to see the floods. We have to emotionally perceive it in order to actually understand we need to take action. Is this something you also think about, this kind of divergence between these two ways of thinking and relating towards the world?
Yes, though I don't have much faith in either of the two methods that you're talking about, though I agree that they're different. The first part is that the kind of computational thinking, to explicate that a little bit, I think, is just the situation, you know, in part that we find ourselves in now, that we think and can only think like machines. And what's happened there is that, you know, we invented this very powerful tool, computation, you know, and we invented these machines for doing computation. And those machines proved to be so powerful and so useful in so many ways that we mistook them for thinking itself, that we forgot that they were just one way of thinking, and we treated them as like the ultimate form of thinking. And they've come to be so dominant in the way that we organize everyday life that it becomes very hard to think otherwise, because anything that can't be kind of translated into a machine representation, anything that can't be reduced to ones and zeros, anything that can't be kind of folded into a database, into those little boxes, is either kind of erased or oppressed. It's kind of completely missed out on, or it's kind of actively fought against. There's a long history of what we do to beings that don't fit within our systems of categorization in all kinds of ways. And that includes both other humans as well as non-human. And computational relations are just like an even more extreme and kind of structured way of doing that, but a very powerful one. Yeah, one of the ways that fails us is this inability to think differently, and inability to admit to other ways of kind of knowing and seeing the world. The emotional, as you describe it, I'm not sure I'd use the word emotional, but the kind of directly perceived interaction with the world does matter as well, but it has its own like incredibly powerful limits. Like I'm very skeptical of the notion of empathy as a way of kind of achieving change. Because as you say, like one of the problems is that most people in the kind of global north don't really experience climate change directly. And so we struggle to think about it or to acknowledge it or to act meaningfully about it. But, you know, the people in global north are really bad at quite a lot of other things as well. We're pretty bad about having meaningful relationships to people who live in other countries, period, to people who have different skin colors to us, who come from different cultures. And really bad stuff happens already as a result of that. There are deep limits to our ability to empathize. Empathy is literally like the ability to kind of emotionally, psychologically embody another, which also is a kind of form of possession and domination. It requires the kind of reduction of the other to something like ourselves, which is a form of violence, because again, something is stripped away from the other to kind of lock it into our experience. And so again, it has these really powerful limits, and it's frankly insufficient for action at a global scale, which is why, you know, I come back again to notions of to agency and to this idea of a place to stand as being something that doesn't depend upon having this kind of either totalizing kind of digital knowledge, this like intense modeling of the world that requires everything to be bullied into ones and zeros, or a kind of emotional empathetic access to others that also has like limitations and failings because it's impossible to know and understand everybody else either. But simply is about like, what can I achieve given, or what can we achieve collectively together through forms of solidarity that don't depend on the kind of dominating forms of knowledge?
So would you say, after reading Ways of Being, or for anyone who listens to this podcast or reads your essays, the call to action for each one of us is to develop more agency and develop this so-called place to stand on our own and within our local communities?
Yeah, absolutely. That's all I know what to do. There may be other things to do too, but like in my writing and in my work, a lot of what I'm trying to do is I'm just kind of showing my workings. I don't make any claim to having answers always. I really try not to. But what I do say is like, here's some things that I found out that I find to be fascinating, that I would love to tell you about. And also like, this is how I go about finding and thinking about them. And if you do also think this is interesting, or you think that there is something missing or unspoken or unsaid or even unsayable within the ways that we think the world at the present, well, here's some of the toolkit for addressing that. Here's some of the things you can do to shift your own perspective, to help others shift their own perspectives, to make it possible to imagine and enact other worlds, because here they are all around us. You know, and that's the work that I'm doing in Ways of Being, in part, is pointing out that we already live within a world filled with such extraordinary splendor and wonder and awe that most of the time we don't notice at all. And yet we can. We are entirely capable of it. It's right there. And here's like a bunch of different ways of noticing it, from like scientific experiments to spiritual experiences, you know, to gardening. Like all of these are places in which you can start to do that work.
I think in the beginning, when we talked about agency, you also mentioned it's very hard to develop agency on your own. It's better or it's easier to do it in community, as part of a system, as part of a bigger effort. May I ask, how is your thinking and your practice influenced by others or by collaborating with others? Like thinking of even Ways of Being as a book, as a result of several years of hard thinking and experimenting. Do you do this on your own, on your island in Greece, or do you do it in community, in collaboration with others?
I mean, a little bit of both, but I don't really ever think of myself as being alone, mostly because I'm almost permanently connected to the internet. And if not the internet, then to like books and periodicals and other systems of knowledge. No one who hasn't consciously taken up the position of a hermitage and had them walled up itself in a cave somewhere has been truly alone on this planet for some time. We are utterly, all utterly, totally enmeshed and entangled with one another all the time. I feel that really any work and all work is collaborative, even if the collaborators are authors of books that I've read, because that act is a kind of interactive and generative one. It depends on the kind of work that you're doing. If you're doing pure knowledge work, you know, research, reading, writing, the time lag of interaction is a bit longer, right? Someone might write a book and you might not read it for years or decades later or whatever. You're still in conversation. It's just happening at a slightly different timescale. And making stuff matters, because it engages a totally different part of the brain, primarily different, you know, outside the linguistic part of the brain, which, you know, requires stimulation and produces things as well, and like produces new things. That can be different. If you want to build something at scale, it helps to have other people. One of the things that's happening is that you're bringing a greater diversity of types of thinking to bear. And so different things happen. You know, if you make something on your own, you will just make the thing that your own mind can produce and your own experience can produce. And that might be interesting and fun in all kinds of ways. It will be different too, and potentially lesser than the thing that can be produced by multiple minds, multiple beings, multiple organisms all working together on a thing. That's a super powerful thing to engage, because collaboration changes everyone who's involved. I think one of the bigger things is you change more when you work in collaboration with others than when you work on your own. Working on one's own tends to be a process of consolidation, of taking the skills that you have and honing them, which is important and useful. And collaboration is about taking those skills and expanding them in some way, like growing them, changing them in different ways, and learning new things from others, and crucially learning together, because that's also the thing. You'll come out of it with things that neither of you knew going in, but somehow you all learn together through that experience. So there's all these different kind of modes and ways that work in cross, but all of my work, I feel, comes out of processes of like very deep collaboration, in the sense that, you know, it's all coming out of things that I've read, things that I've learned, things that have been produced. But there's no hermit on a mountain here. There's only like all of these things buzzing around.
Yeah. And you mentioned you are very much using the technologies, using the apps, using the internet that you also criticize, but you also take the benefit from them for your own use and within your agency that you develop continuously, right?
Well, I mean, we all live under capitalism, but it's possible to make choices, not always the most ethical ones, but like you can make choices. You can choose the tools you use, for example. I always give actually the example of what we're doing right now. We tried using another platform and it failed, so we're back on Zoom. And I always give the example of Zoom because I always find myself talking about this over Zoom, and I find it incredibly frustrating because it's such a classic example of what I'm talking about, which is that of all the ways we could use a computer and all the ways we could use computers to talk to each other right now, we're using somebody else's centralizing profit-seeking system, right? And what I mean by that is that this is a system which takes input from my side, input from your side, and routes them to each other through a big central server, through Zoom's technological infrastructure, which allows them to extract information and profit from us doing so. And that's a choice we're making right now, to give them information about ourselves that they can turn into profit. And that's empowering them in the process of disempowering us. It's like a clear trade-off that's occurring. And that doesn't have to be that way. There's other tools we could use that are structured differently, that also critically produce different outcomes. So if we were to use a kind of peer-to-peer video system, that would likely have been created in this kind of open source manner through the collaboration empowerment of many developers that anyone else could pick up, both learn from, but also develop further, use in different ways. It also would route our inputs, our conversations from either side differently across the network, so that there would not be some like single concentration of power produced by us having a conversation that has nothing to do with that power. And in fact, it would reshape the network around this kind of distributed model of power and of thought and of contribution that would in turn and in time produce a kind of different topology of the network and of power itself. It's an active choice to which tools you use and what kind of power structures are produced by those choices and what kind of empowerments we have. We have a choice whether every time we use any kind of tool, who we give our power to, and how much we choose to develop our own power as part of that usage. In almost any system beyond like absolute dictatorship in which we lack any kind of freedom whatsoever, we always have that choice. You know, and we can make that choice at pretty much every moment in the things that we use.
That was James Bridle in the spring of 2023. If you are interested in reading more about intelligence, ecology, and the modern human world, I can highly recommend reading Ways of Being, their latest book. This is the Culture and Technology Podcast, produced by the Vienna Business Agency. The Vienna Business Agency supports new companies, projects, and products that develop Vienna's creative industries further.